Jewish War, Book 6. The disasters at Jerusalem grew worse day by day. The rebels, goaded on all the more by their misfortunes, and famine, having already devoured the common people, now preyed on them as well. The heaps of corpses piled up throughout the city were a horrifying sight and gave off a pestilential stench, and they hindered any sortie against the enemy, since men advancing had to trample the bodies underfoot, as if marching across a battlefield already churned up by countless slaughter. Yet those who trod on them felt neither horror nor pity, nor took the outrage done to the dead as an evil omen for themselves. Instead, with hands still stained by the blood of their own countrymen, they rushed out to fight the foreign enemy, reproaching, it seems to me, the divine for its slowness in punishing them. For their war was no longer driven by hope of victory, but by despair of survival. The Romans, though they had labored greatly to gather timber, razed their earthworks in 21 days, having stripped bare, as already mentioned, the whole country around the city for 90 stadia in every direction. The sight of the land itself was pitiable. Places once adorned with trees and pleasure gardens now lay stripped and desolate on every side, their timber cut away. No foreigner who had seen the old Judea and the city's beautiful suburbs, and then looked upon the desolation now before him, could fail to grieve and groan at so great a change. The war had ruined every mark of its former beauty, and no one who had known the place before could have recognized it if suddenly set down there. Rather, standing on the very spot, he would still have gone looking for the city. The completion of the earthwork struck Romans and Jews alike with an equal dread, though from opposite causes. The Jews expected that if these works too were burned, the city would fall. The Romans, for their part, feared that if these were destroyed as well, they would never take the city at all. For timber was scarce, and the soldiers' bodies were worn out by their labors, while their spirits were worn down by one setback after another. Indeed, the disasters within the city weighed more heavily on Roman morale than on that of the besieged. For despite such great suffering, the defenders showed no softening in their fighting. Rather, the Romans found their hopes constantly dashed by the enemy's schemes against the earthworks, by the solidity of the wall against their engines, and by the daring of those they grappled with hand to hand. Worst of all, amid faction, famine, war, and so many evils, they still found the Jews' courage undiminished. They concluded that these men's onslaughts were irresistible and their cheerfulness under disaster unconquerable. For what would such men not endure if fortune ever favored them, seeing that misfortune itself only drove them to greater strength? For these reasons, the Romans kept a stronger guard over the earthworks. John and his men at the Antonia, looking ahead to what would happen if the wall were breached, took precautions of their own, and before the battering rams could be brought up, they moved first against the works. But they did not succeed in their attempt. Advancing with torches, they turned back, their courage cooler than their hope, before they had even reached the earthworks. In the first place, their plan showed no coordination. They dashed out in scattered groups, in fits and starts, hesitant and fearful, in short, nothing like the Jewish way of fighting. Gone was the nation's characteristic boldness, the rush and charge of the whole body together, and the refusal to turn back even when struck down. Advancing with less than their usual vigor, they found the Romans, too, drawn up in stronger than customary order. With their bodies and full armor, the Romans had fenced in the earthworks on every side, so that fire could find no opening anywhere, and each man had steeled his spirit not to leave his post before death. For besides the loss of all their hopes if these works too should be burned, the soldiers felt a fierce shame at the thought that in the end craft would defeat courage, desperation defeat weapons, numbers defeat experience, and that Jews would defeat Romans. At the same time, their artillery joined in, striking down those who darted forward. A man falling became an obstacle to the one behind him, and the danger of advancing further made the rest more hesitant. Those who ran in under the range of missiles were, some of them, terrified before they even came to close quarters by the enemy's discipline and close ranks, others driven back by the jabs of long spears, and in the end, hurling accusations of cowardice at one another, they withdrew without accomplishing anything. This attack took place on the first of the month Paneus. Once the Jews had withdrawn, the Romans brought up their siege engines. Though pelted with stones from the Antonia, and with fire and iron, and every kind of missile that necessity supplied to the Jews. For though they placed great confidence in their wall and despised the Roman engines, they still tried to prevent the Romans from bringing them up. The Romans, supposing that the Jews' eagerness to keep the Antonia from being struck arose from weakness in the wall, and hoping the foundations were unsound, pressed their efforts all the harder in response. But the part under attack did not give way. Some men, though continually under fire and yielding to none of the dangers from above, kept the siege engines working, while others, when their numbers grew too thin and they were being battered by the stones, roofed themselves over with shields and, working with hands and levers beneath this cover, undermined the foundations, and by persistent effort dislodged four stones. Night gave both sides a rest, and during it the wall, already shaken by the battering rams, and undermined at the point where John, in his counter-scheme against the earlier earthworks, had dug his tunnel, which now gave way, suddenly collapsed. This event, coming unexpectedly, affected the spirits of each side in an unexpected way. The Jews, who might have been expected to lose heart, instead took courage, since the collapse had not caught them unprepared. They had already fortified themselves against it, believing the Antonia would still stand. But the Romans' unexpected joy at the wall's fall was quickly extinguished by the sight of a second wall, which John and his men had built up from within. Still, this assault appeared easier than the last. It seemed simpler to climb up through the rubble of the fallen wall, and this inner wall seemed far weaker than the Antonia itself, and, being hastily built, they supposed it would soon give way. Yet no one dared to climb up, for death was the certain fate awaiting whoever went first. Titus, believing that the eagerness of fighting men is roused above all by hope and by words, and that exhortation and promises often banish the memory of danger, and sometimes even contempt for death itself, gathered the bravest of his men together and tried to move them, speaking as follows: "Fellow soldiers, to urge men on to dangers that bring them no benefit is itself an inglorious thing to do, and indeed it brings upon the one urging it a charge of cowardice. Exhortation, I think, should be reserved for undertakings that are genuinely hazardous, since anything else is worth doing on its own merits. So then, I myself set before you plainly how hard the climb to that wall will be, but that it is above all fitting for men who aspire to valor to contend with difficulties, that death in glory is a noble thing, and that the courage of those who lead the way will not go unrewarded, this I will explain. First, let something that might discourage some of you instead spur you on: the endurance of the Jews and their capacity to bear hardship. For it would be shameful for men who are Romans and soldiers of mine, who have been trained for war in peacetime and are accustomed to victory in war, to be inferior to Jews in either strength of arm or strength of spirit. And this too when we stand at the very threshold of victory, with God fighting on our side. Our setbacks have come from Jewish desperation. Their sufferings grow through your courage and God's cooperation. Faction, famine, siege, and walls falling without the aid of siege engines, what could these be but God's wrath against them and God's help to us? It would not be right for us not only to be outdone by lesser men, but also to betray the divine alliance granted to us. And is it not shameful that Jews, for whom defeat and enslavement carry little disgrace since they have grown used to it, should hold death in contempt in order to escape it no longer, and should often rush out into our very midst, not in hope of victory, but simply to display their courage? While you, who rule nearly the whole earth and sea, for whom not to win is itself a disgrace, and who have not once ventured against the enemy, sit here idle waiting for famine and fortune to do the work against them, though armed as you are, when with only a moment's risk you could accomplish the whole task. Once we have climbed up to the Antonia, we hold the city. And even if there should still be some fighting against those within, which I do not expect, holding the high ground and sitting astride the enemy's very breath will quickly guarantee complete victory. For my part, I will set aside for now any praise of death in war, and any talk of the immortality that awaits those who fall in the fury of battle, and instead I will pronounce a curse on those who choose otherwise, on those who die in peacetime from disease, for whom the soul is buried along with the body. For who among good men does not know that souls released from the flesh by the sword in battle are welcomed by the purest of elements, the ether, and set among the stars, appearing to their own descendants afterward as benevolent spirits and kindly heroes. While souls that waste away in diseased bodies, however free from stain or pollution they may be, are swallowed by a darkness beneath the earth and received into deep oblivion, losing at once their life, their bodies, and even the memory of themselves. But if death by necessity is spun out for all men alike, and the sword is a gentler servant to it than any disease, how can it be anything but base to refuse to circumstance what we shall in any case owe to fate? I have said all this as though those who make the attempt could not survive it. But even from the most perilous ventures, survival is possible for men who act with courage. First, what has already fallen is easy to climb. And besides, anything hastily built is easily broken down. You who go in greater numbers, take courage and be to one another both encouragement and support, and your own resolve will quickly break the enemy's spirit. Perhaps the success will even cost you no blood at all, if only you make the beginning. For while they will likely try to stop you as you climb, once you have gotten past them unnoticed and forced your way in, they will no longer be able to hold out, however few of you get there first. As for the one who leads the way, I would be ashamed not to make him an object of envy for the rewards he receives. And while the living will command men who are now his equals, blessings will follow the fallen as well, in the form of highest honors. While Titus was saying such things, most of the men were afraid at the magnitude of the danger. But among those serving in the cohorts was one named Sabinus, a Syrian by birth, who proved himself best in both strength of arm and strength of spirit. And yet, to judge merely by his physical build, one would not have expected him to be even an ordinary soldier. He was dark-skinned, thin, and his flesh was shrunken close to the bone, but within that slight frame, far too narrow for the strength it held, dwelt a truly heroic spirit. He was the first to stand up. "I offer myself to you eagerly, Caesar," he said. "I will be the first to climb the wall. And I pray that my strength and resolve may keep pace with your fortune. But if I should fail in the attempt, know that I did not fall through misjudgment, but chose death deliberately for your sake." With these words, holding his shield above his head with his left hand and drawing his sword with his right, he advanced toward the wall at about the sixth hour of the day. 11 others followed him, the only men who proved themselves rivals in courage. The man himself pressed far ahead of them all, driven by something like a divine impulse. The guards on the wall hurled javelins down at them, showered them with countless missiles from every side, and rolled down huge stones, which swept some of the 11 away. But Sabinus, meeting the missiles head-on and buried under a hail of projectiles, did not check his charge until he had reached the top and put the enemy to flight. For the Jews, terrified by his strength and force of spirit, and thinking that many more men had climbed up besides him, turned and fled. Here one might justly accuse fortune of begrudging men their virtues and of always thwarting extraordinary achievements. For this man, just when he had won his goal, stumbled, tripped against a rock, and fell forward upon it with a tremendous crash. The Jews, turning back and seeing him alone and fallen, pelted him with missiles from every side. He rose to his knees, and covering himself with his shield, at first defended himself and wounded many of those who came close. But then, overwhelmed by the number of his wounds, his right arm gave way, and at last, before he could breathe his last, he was buried under the missiles. A man who deserved, for his courage, a better fortune, though his fall matched the greatness of his undertaking. Of the others, 3 who had already reached the top were crushed with stones and killed, while the remaining 8, wounded, were dragged back and carried to the camp. This happened on the 3rd of the month Painmas. 2 days later, some 20 of the sentries who kept watch by night at the earthworks banded together. Pretending to be the standard-bearer of the 5th Legion, along with 2 cavalrymen from the squadrons and a single trumpeter, at about the 9th hour of the night, they advanced quietly through the ruins toward the Antonia. Cutting the throats of the first guards, who were asleep, they took possession of the wall and ordered the trumpeter to sound the signal. At this, the rest of the guards leaped up in sudden panic and fled before anyone could see how few of the attackers there actually were. For both their fear and the trumpet call gave them the impression that a great number of the enemy had climbed up. When Caesar heard the signal, he armed his forces with all speed and, together with his officers, was himself the first to climb up, with his chosen men beside him. The Jews had fled into the temple, and the Romans too now poured in through the tunnel which John had dug toward the Roman earthworks. The rebels of both factions, John's and Simon's, spread out and block them, sparing no effort of either strength or determination. Beyond measure, they took the Romans' entry into the sanctuary as marking the end of the city's capture, and the Romans took it, for their part, as the beginning of mastering it. A fierce battle broke out around the entrances, the Romans forcing their way in to seize the temple as well, the Jews pushing them back toward the Antonia. Arrows and spears were useless to both sides, they drew their swords and grappled hand to hand, and in the crush it was impossible to tell which men were fighting for which side. The combatants were jumbled together in the narrow space, and the shouting, swelled by its sheer volume, carried no meaning. The slaughter on both sides was heavy, and the fighters trampled and shattered the bodies and armor of the fallen as they fought. Wherever the tide of battle happened to press, there were cheers from the side gaining ground and wailing from the side giving way. There was no room either for flight or for pursuit. Instead, the battle line, all mixed together, swayed one way and then the other in near even balance. Men in the front ranks had no choice but to kill or be killed, since there was no way to retreat. Those pressing forward from behind on both sides left their own comrades no gap to fall back into, not even within the fighting itself. The Jews' fury was gaining the upper hand over the Romans' skill, and the whole battle line was now on the point of giving way. They had been fighting from the ninth hour of the night to the seventh hour of the day. The Jews fought in a single mass, with the danger of the city's capture supplying them courage, while the Romans fought with only part of their force, since the legions had not yet come up. The men then engaged were husbanding their strength for them, judging that for the present it was enough to hold the Antonia. There was a centurion named Julianus, from Bithynia, no obscure man. Among all those whose deeds I recorded in the course of that war, he was the best in skill at arms, in bodily strength, and in steadiness of soul. He was standing beside Titus at the Antonia, and when he saw the Romans already giving ground and defending themselves badly, he leaped forward and single-handed drove back the Jews just as they were winning, all the way to the corner of the inner temple. The whole crowd fled before him, unable to believe that his strength and daring were human. Darting this way and that through the scattering men, he cut down everyone he overtook, and neither Titus nor anyone else present ever beheld a more astonishing or more terrifying sight. But he too, it turned out, was being pursued by fate, which no mortal can escape. His boots were studded with thick, sharp nails, like every other soldier's, and as he ran over the paved stone he slipped. Falling on his back with a tremendous clatter of armor, he made the fleeing men turn around. A cry went up from the Romans on the Antonia, fearing for him, and the Jews closed round him in a mass and struck at him from every side with spears and swords. He caught much of the iron on his shield, and though he tried again and again to get up, he was knocked down by the sheer number of men striking him. Even lying there, he kept stabbing many with his sword. He was not killed quickly, protected as he was by helmet and breastplate and pulling in his neck to guard every vital spot for a death blow, until his other limbs were hacked at, and with no one daring to come to his aid, he finally gave out. Titus was overcome with grief to see so brave a man cut down before so many eyes. The ground kept him, eager as he was from going to help, and terror kept back those who could have. Julianus, then, after a long, hard death, leaving few of his killers unwounded, was at last cut down, leaving behind the greatest renown not only among the Romans and with Titus, but among the enemy as well. The Jews seized his body, then turned on the Romans again and drove them back, shutting them up in the Antonia. Among the Jews, those who distinguished themselves in this battle were Alexas and Gyphtheus of John's company, from Simon's men, Milatius and Judas son of Murto, Jacob son of Sosas, commander of the Idumeans, and among the Zealots, two brothers, sons of Ari, Simon and Judes. Titus ordered the soldiers with him to demolish the foundations of the Antonia and to prepare an easy ascent for the whole army. Then he summoned Josephus. He had learned that on that very day, the 17th of Paneus, the daily sacrifice called the Tamid had lapsed for lack of men to offer it, and that the people were deeply distressed by this. He therefore told Josephus to say to John again what he had said before, that if some fatal passion for fighting possessed him, he was free to go out with as many men as he wished and fight, without dragging the city and the temple down with himself, but that he must stop desecrating the sanctuary and sinning against God, and that he was welcome to carry out the sacrifices that had lapsed, using whichever Jews he chose to select. So Josephus, positioning himself where not only John but the crowd as well could hear him, delivered Titus's message in Hebrew and added many pleas of his own. To spare the homeland, to drive back the fire that was already tasting the temple, and to restore the offerings to God. At this, the people fell into gloomy silence, but the tyrant, after heaping abuse and curses on Josephus, added at the end that he would never fear the city's capture, for the city belonged to God. To this Josephus cried out, "You have indeed kept it pure for God, the sanctuary remains undefiled, and against the ally you hope for you have committed no offense. He is receiving his customary sacrifices. But if someone took away your daily food, you utterly godless man, you would count him an enemy. Yet the very God you have robbed of his eternal worship, do you expect to have him as your ally in this war? And do you lay the blame on the Romans, who to this day care for our laws and are forcing the sacrifices you cut off to be restored to God? Who would not groan and lament over the city's astonishing reversal, when foreigners and enemies are correcting your impiety, while you, a Jew raised in the law, prove harsher toward it than they are? But John, there is no shame in repenting of wrongdoing even at the last, and if you wish to save your country, a noble example lies before you. Jeconiah, king of the Jews, who, when the Babylonian marched against him on his own account, willingly gave himself up before the city was taken and endured captivity of his own free will, along with his family, rather than hand over these holy things to the enemy and stand by while the house of God went up in flames. For this reason, a sacred tradition celebrates him among all the Jews, and a memory flowing down through the ages, ever fresh, hands him on immortal to those who come after. A noble example, John, even if it carries danger, and I myself pledge you pardon from the Romans as well. Remember that I urge this as your countryman and promise it as a Jew, and you should consider who is advising you and from where. May I myself never become so much a captive while I live that I cease to belong to my people or forget my ancestral ways. You grow indignant again and shout abuse at me, deserving, I admit, of still harsher words, since I am urging something flatly against fate and forcing the men God has condemned to be saved. Who does not know the writings of the ancient prophets and the oracle now already bearing down on this unhappy city? For they foretold its capture whenever one of its own people should begin the slaughter of kinsmen. And is not the city, is not the whole temple, filled with your own people's corpses? God, then, God himself is bringing the purifying fire, together with the Romans, and is tearing away a city stuffed with so much pollution. As Josephus spoke these words, his voice broke with sobbing amid his grief and tears. The Romans pitied him for his suffering and admired his resolve, but John's men were only further provoked against the Romans, desiring now to get Josephus himself into their power as well. Still, his words moved many of the nobility. Some, afraid of the rebels' guards, stayed where they were, though they had already given up themselves and the city for lost. Others watched for their chance, found a safe way out, and fled to the Romans. Among these were the chief priests Josephus and Jesus, three sons of the high priest Ishmael, who had been beheaded at Cyrene, four sons of Matthias, and one son of another Matthias, who had escaped after his father's death, his father having been killed, along with three sons, by Simon son of Gioras, as already related. Many other nobles went over to the Romans along with the chief priests. Titus received them kindly in every respect, and knowing that living among people of foreign customs would be unpleasant for them, he sent them off to Gophna, advising them to stay there for the time being. Once he had leisure after the war, he said, he would restore each man's property. So they withdrew gladly to the little town assigned them, in complete safety. But when they were no longer seen, the rebels once again spread the rumor that the deserters had been killed by the Romans, clearly meaning to frighten the rest away from deserting. And, as before, the trick worked for a while. Men were held back from deserting by fear. But later, when Titus recalled the men from Gophna and had them go around the wall with Josephus so that the people could see them, a great many fled over to the Romans. Gathering in a body and standing before the Romans, they begged the rebels, weeping and wailing, first to receive the Romans into the whole city and save their homeland after all, or failing that, at least to withdraw from the temple and spare it for them. For the Romans, they said, would never dare burn the sanctuary except under the direst compulsion. But this only made the rebels more contentious. Shouting back much abuse at the deserters, they stationed catapults, spear throwers, and stone throwing engines at the sacred gates, so that the temple's surrounding precincts came to resemble a mass grave for the sheer number of dead, and the sanctuary itself a fortress. They rushed with their weapons into the holy places, forbidden to enter, their hands still warm with the blood of their own kinsmen, and carried their lawlessness so far that whatever indignation the Jews would have felt had the Romans committed such outrages against them, that same indignation now came from the Romans against Jews who were desecrating what was their own. Indeed, there was not a single soldier who did not gaze at the temple with a shudder and bow before it, praying that the rebels would repent before disaster beyond remedy overtook them. Titus, overcome with feeling, once more reproached John's men, saying, "Was it not you, you utterly vile men, who set up this stone balustrade in front of the holy places? Was it not you who erected the pillars on it, inscribed in Greek and in our own language, forbidding anyone to cross the barrier? And did we not allow you to kill anyone who crossed it, even if you were a Roman? Why then, you polluted wretches, do you now trample corpses inside it? Why do you drench the temple with the blood of foreigners and of your own people alike? I call to witness the gods of my fathers and any god who ever watched over this place. Though I doubt any still does, I call to witness my own army, the Jews who serve with me, and you yourselves, that I am not forcing you to defile this. If you will only shift the site of your battle, no Roman will approach the holy places or insult them. I will preserve the temple for you, even against your will." When Josephus relayed this message from Titus, the rebels and the tyrant, supposing that these entreaties came not from goodwill but from cowardice, only grew more contemptuous. Titus, seeing that the men showed neither pity for themselves nor any regard for the temple, turned again, reluctantly, to war. He could not bring his whole force against them, since the ground would not hold it, so he picked out the 30 best men from each century, assigned 1,000 to each tribune, put Cereales in command of them, and ordered them to attack the guard posts around the 9th hour of the night. He himself had put on his armor and was prepared to go down with them, but his friends held him back because of the sheer danger, and so did the advice of his officers. They told him he would accomplish more by sitting at the Antonia and directing the battle for his soldiers than by going down to risk himself in the front line, since with Titus watching, all the men would fight bravely. Persuaded by this, and telling the soldiers he would stay behind for this one reason, so that he could judge their merits, so that no brave man would go unrewarded and no coward unpunished, and so that the one who held power both to punish and to honor might himself see and witness everything, he sent the men off to carry out the action at the appointed hour, while he himself went forward to a spot on the Antonia with a clear view and waited tensely to see what would happen. Yet those who were sent did not find the guards asleep, as they had hoped. The guards sprang up and immediately closed with them, shouting. At the noise of the men roused from their beds, the rest inside poured out in a mass. The Romans held off the first onrush, but those coming up behind fell in confusion among their own ranks, and many treated their own comrades as enemies. Recognition by voice was made impossible by the shouting mingled together on both sides, and recognition by sight was taken away by the darkness. Men were blinded besides, some by rage, some by fear, so that it was impossible to tell whom one struck when one struck at whoever came in reach. The Romans, however, since they kept their shields locked together and advanced in formation, suffered less from this confusion, for each man kept the watchword in mind. The Jews, by contrast, were always scattering and making their attacks and retreats without order, so that they often gave one another the impression of being enemies. In the dark, each man took a comrade returning to his side for an advancing Roman. More of them, in fact, were wounded by their own side than by the enemy, until day came and the fighting could at last be told apart by sight. Then they drew up in ranks and used their missiles and their defenses in proper order. Neither side yielded or grew weary. The Romans, as though under Titus's own eyes, vied with one another man against man and company against company, each one striving for. That day would be his to begin, if only he fought bravely. What drove the Jews to their daring was fear for themselves and for the temple, and the tyrant standing over them, urging some on and whipping others into action with threats. For the most part, the fighting stayed within a stade's length, but the balance of it swung back and forth quickly and within a short space, since neither side had room for a long flight or a long pursuit. The uproar from the Antonia kept pace with whatever was happening, as men shouted encouragement to their own side when it had the upper hand and called on it to stand firm when it gave ground. It was like a kind of theater of war. Nothing that happened in the battle escaped Titus or the men around him. In the end, having begun at the ninth hour of the night, they broke off after the fifth hour of the day, neither side clearly forcing back the other, but leaving the victory suspended between them, evenly balanced. Many Romans fought with distinction, on the Jewish side from Simon's men, Jude son of Merodus and Simon son of Hosea, from the Idumeans, Jacob son of Achaitlas and Simon son of Sosas, from John's men, Jephthias and Alexas, and from the Zealots, Simon son of Ari. Meanwhile, the rest of the Roman force spent 7 days demolishing the foundations of the Antonia and clearing a broad road all the way to the temple. When the legions drew near the first enclosure, they began raising earthworks at 4 points, one opposite the corner of the inner temple, which lay to the north and west, a second opposite the northern exedra, between the two gates, a third opposite the western portico of the outer temple, and the fourth outside, against the north side. The work went forward, but only with great toil and hardship, since they had to bring the timber in from 100 stades away. They also suffered from ambushes here and there, though their overwhelming strength made them less cautious, and the Jews, now past hoping for their own survival, grew bolder still. Whenever some of the cavalry went out for wood or to gather fodder, they would unbridle their horses during the time it took to collect it and let them graze, and the Jews would dash out in a body and seize them. This kept happening, and Caesar, rightly judging that the losses came more from his own men's carelessness than from Jewish courage, decided to deal more sternly with the rest to make them guard their horses. He ordered one of the soldiers who had lost his horse led away to execution, and the fear of that kept the others watchful from then on. They no longer let the animals out to graze, but took them out only as needed, staying close beside them as if grown together with them. The legions, for their part, went on pressing the siege of the temple and pushing the earthworks forward. A day after they had begun this ascent, many of the insurgents, now running short of plunder and hard pressed by famine, banded together and attacked the Roman guard posts on the Mount of Olives at about the 11th hour of the day, thinking that they would catch them unprepared, and further, that the men would already be attending to their own needs and so be easy to break through. But the Romans sensed their approach in advance and, rallying quickly from the nearby forts, kept them from leaping the barricade wall or forcing a breach in it. In the fierce clash that followed, both sides performed many acts of courage. The Romans relying on strength combined with skill in war, the Jews on reckless impulse and uncontrollable fury. What drove the one side was a sense of honor, the other necessity. It seemed utterly shameful to the Romans to let Jews slip free once caught as if in a net, while the Jews had only one hope of survival, to force their way through and break the wall. One of the cavalry from a squadron, a man named Pedanius, when the Jews had already begun to give way and were being pressed together down toward the ravine, rode past at an angle and snatching up one of the fleeing enemy, a young man, powerfully built and in full armor, seized him by the ankle. He leaned so far down from his galloping horse and showed such strength of arm and body besides, along with sheer skill in horsemanship, that he simply carried the man off as if he were some prize and brought his captive to Caesar. Titus, marveling at the strength of the one who had made the capture, ordered the one who had been caught punished for his attack on the wall, and himself returned to the fighting around the temple and to pressing on the earthworks. During this time, the Jews, worn down by the constant clashes as the war crept ever nearer, coiling closer around the sanctuary, kept cutting off the parts already infected, like limbs from a rotting body, to stop the disease spreading further. They set fire to the section of the northern and western portico that connected to the Antonia, and then, working with their own hands, tore away about 20 cubits of it, so beginning to burn the sacred building themselves. 2 days later, on the 24th of the month already named, the Romans set the next stretch of portico ablaze, and once the fire had eaten its way along for 15 cubits, the Jews likewise cut away the roof, never entirely abandoning the work and cutting the section joined to the Antonia loose from the rest. So although they could have stopped the fire spreading, they instead held back until it reached the point they wanted, and so measured out its advance to their own advantage. Around the temple, the fighting never let up. The war ran on continuously as men in turns rushed out against each other. Among the Jews at this time was a man short in stature and unimpressive to look at, of no distinction by birth or otherwise. His name was Jonathan, who came forward by the tomb of the high priest John and hurled arrogant taunts of every kind at the Romans, challenging their best man to single combat. Most of the men drawn up there simply despised him, though some, quite reasonably, were afraid. And a thought not without sense occurred to a few, that it was unwise to grapple with a man courting death, since men who have given up on their own survival let their impulses run unchecked and no longer fear the divine, and that risking a fight against such a man made victory of little worth, while a shameful defeat would be dangerous. This was not courage, but recklessness. For a good while no one came forward, and the Jew kept mocking them at length as cowards, until a certain Pudens, one of the cavalry of a squadron, a man full of his own conceit and contemptuous of the Romans besides, revolted by the man's words and insolence, and no doubt also, without thinking it through, emboldened by the fellow's small stature, leaped forward. He had the better of the exchange in every other respect, but was betrayed by fortune. As he fell, Jonathan rushed up and cut his throat. Then, standing over the corpse, he brandished his bloodied sword, raised his shield in his left hand, and shouted taunts at the army, boasting over the fallen man and jeering at the watching Romans, until, as he pranced about in his mockery, a centurion named Priscus shot an arrow through him. A cry went up at once from both Jews and Romans, though of very different kinds. Jonathan, spinning from the pain, fell across the body of his enemy, proof, if war ever needed it, of how swiftly retribution can overtake a man whose luck has run beyond reason. The insurgents up on the temple went on openly resisting the soldiers at the earthworks, defending against them day after day. And on the 27th of the aforesaid month, they contrived the following stratagem. They filled the space between the beams and the ceiling beneath them, in the western portico, with dry wood and with asphalt and pitch besides. Then they pretended to give way, as if worn down. Many of the less cautious Romans, carried away by the impulse of the moment, pressed after the retreating men and set ladders against the portico and scrambled up onto it, while the more sensible ones, suspecting the Jews' flight was too irrational to be genuine, held back. Even so, the portico filled up with those who had climbed up, and at that moment the Jews set the whole thing ablaze. As the flame shot up suddenly on every side, a terrible panic seized the Romans who were outside the danger, and helplessness seized those trapped within it. Surrounded by the fire, some flung themselves backward into the city, others among the enemy, and many, hoping to save themselves, leaped down among their own comrades and broke their limbs. The fire overtook the flight of most, and some found the flame reaching them by way of the sword as well, for it spread out and consumed even those trying to escape by other means over a wide stretch. Caesar, though angry at the men for having climbed up without orders, was nonetheless moved to pity for them, and since no one could go to their aid, this at least was some comfort to the dying, to see the man for whose sake they were giving up their lives grieving on their behalf. For he could be seen shouting to them, springing forward, and urging the men around him to help however they could. Each man, in his cries and in his bearing, met death cheerfully, carrying it off as though it were some glorious burial garment. Some retreated onto the broad section of the portico wall and so escaped the fire, but were then surrounded by the Jews. For a long while they held out under repeated wounds, but in the end they all fell, the last of them a young man named Longus, who crowned the whole tragic scene, and who, though every one of the fallen deserved to be remembered man by man, proved the best of them all. The Jews, admiring his valor and unable in any case to kill him outright, called on him to come down to them under pledge of safety, while his brother Cornelius, from the other side, urged him not to disgrace his own reputation and that of the Roman army. Persuaded by this, and lifting his sword in plain view of both armies, he took his own life. Among those trapped by the fire, a man named Artorius saved himself by a trick. Calling out to a fellow soldier named Lucius, his tentmate, he shouted at the top of his voice, I leave you heir to my property if you come and catch me. Lucius ran up readily to catch him. The one who threw himself down survived, landing on him, but the one who caught him, crushed by the weight, was dashed against the pavement and died on the spot. This disaster caused the Romans some despair for a time, but it also, in the longer run, left them not without a lesson. It made them more guarded and helped them become more wary of Jewish tricks, the kind that had cost them so much before through ignorance of the terrain and of the character of the men they faced. The portico burned as far as John's Tower, which he had built during his war against Simon, above the gates leading out over the terrace. The rest of it the Jews cut away themselves, once the men who had climbed up were already dead. The next day the Romans in turn burned the whole northern portico as far as the eastern one, at the corner where it joined the ravine called the Kidron, which was built up high above it, a spot whose depth alone was enough to inspire dread. Such, then, was the state of affairs around the temple. Of those perishing from famine throughout the city, the number that fell was beyond counting, and the sufferings that took place defy description. In every house, wherever the least shadow of food appeared, war broke out, and the closest of kin came to blows with one another, snatching away the wretched provisions that kept the soul in the body. Not even the dying were trusted in their want. The brigands searched even the dying as they breathed their last, in case someone was concealing food under his clothes and merely feigning death. Men gaping with hunger reeled about like mad dogs, stumbling against doors as if drunk, and in their desperation would burst into the same houses two or three times within a single hour. Need drove them to gnaw at anything at all, and they forced themselves to collect and eat things not fit even for the filthiest of dumb animals. In the end, they did not even refrain from belts and shoes, and stripped the leather from their shields and chewed on it. Some fed on tufts of old hay, for there were those who gathered the fibers and sold the smallest weight of it for 4 Attic drachmas. But why should I speak of the shamelessness the famine showed even toward lifeless things? I am about to reveal a deed of a kind recorded neither among Greeks nor among barbarians, dreadful to tell, and scarcely believable to hear. For my own part, I would gladly have passed over this calamity, for fear of seeming to later generations to be telling a monstrous tale, had I not had countless witnesses to it among my own contemporaries. And besides, I would be doing my homeland a cold favor if I suppressed, in my account, the sufferings it actually endured. There was a woman among those living beyond the Jordan, named Mary, daughter of Eleazar, from the village of Bethizuba, which means house of hyssop. A woman distinguished by family and wealth, who had fled with the rest of the crowd into Jerusalem and was now caught up in the siege with them. Most of her possessions, everything she had gathered up and brought with her from Perea into the city, the tyrants had already plundered, and whatever remained of her valuables, along with any food she managed to find or think up from day to day, the guards would burst in and seize. A terrible indignation took hold of the woman, and time and again she would curse and abuse the plunderers, trying to provoke them into killing her. But since no one, whether out of anger or out of pity, would put her to death, and since finding any food at all had become exhausting even for others, while everywhere it had grown simply impossible to find any, the famine worked its way through her very insides and marrow, and her rage burned hotter still than the hunger. Taking fury as her counselor, together with necessity, she turned against nature itself. She had a child still at the breast. Snatching up the infant, she said, "Poor child, in war, famine, and civil strife, for what am I to keep you? Slavery awaits us under the Romans, if we should even live to see them, but famine will overtake that slavery first, and the rebels are crueler than either. Come, be food for me, an avenging spirit to the rebels, and a story for the world, the one thing still missing from the calamities of the Jews." And as she said this, she killed her son, then she roasted him and ate half and covered up and kept the rest. The rebels were on her at once, having caught the forbidden smell, and threatened to cut her throat then and there unless she showed them what she had prepared. She told them she had kept a fine portion for them too, and uncovered the remains of her child. They were seized at once with horror and dread and stood frozen at the sight. She said, "This is my own child and my own doing. Eat, for I too have eaten. I have eaten. Do not become softer than a woman or more tender-hearted than a mother. But if you are pious men and turn away from my sacrifice, then I have already eaten my share. Let the rest remain for me as well." At this, the men went out trembling, cowards in this one thing alone, and barely yielding this food to the mother. At once the whole city was filled with the pollution, and each man, picturing the horror before his eyes, shuddered as though he himself had dared it. Those who were starving were eager for death, and counted blessed those who had died before hearing and seeing evils so great. The horror was soon reported to the Romans as well. Some of them refused to believe it, others pitied the Jews, but most were driven by it to a still fiercer hatred of the nation. Caesar, for his part, defended himself before God on this very matter too, declaring that he had offered the Jews peace, self-government, and amnesty for all their offenses, but that they had chosen sedition over conquered, war over peace, and famine over abundance and plenty, and had with their own hands begun to burn down the temple that he had been preserving for them. For that they deserved even such food as this. He said he would nonetheless bury the abomination of this child-eating beneath the ruin of their own homeland, and would not leave standing under the sun, for all the world to see, a city in which mothers were fed in such a way. And yet, he said, such food was more fitting for fathers than for mothers, fathers who, even after such sufferings, still remained under arms. Even as he said all this, he thought of the men's desperation. For it was unlikely, he judged, that men who had already suffered everything a man could suffer would ever recover their senses without going on to suffer still more. Now that the two legions had finished their earthworks, on the 8th of the month Lous, he ordered the battering rams brought up against the western portico of the outer temple. For 6 days before this, the strongest of all the siege engines had been battering the wall without effect. The great size and close fitting of the stones defeated it, as they did the others. Meanwhile, other soldiers were undermining the foundations of the northern gate, and after great labor managed to lever out the stones in front. The gate was held up by the stones behind it and stood firm, until, giving up on their efforts with machines and levers, they brought ladders up to the porticos. The Jews did not manage to stop them in time, but fell upon the men once they had climbed up and fought them, thrusting some backward off the wall to their deaths, cutting down others as they met them, striking down with their swords many more before they could even set their shields as they stepped off the ladders, and tipping over some ladders still crowded with soldiers, hurling them down from above. Their own losses, too, were not small. The men who had carried the standards up fought to the last around them, thinking it a fearful disgrace to let them be seized. In the end, the Jews captured the standards and killed the men who had climbed up. The rest, dismayed at the fate of the fallen, withdrew. On the Roman side, not a single man died without a fight, but among the rebels those who had also distinguished themselves bravely in earlier battles fell now as well, among them Eleazar, nephew of the tyrant Simon. Titus, seeing that his forbearance toward the temple of a foreign people was only bringing harm and death to his own soldiers, ordered the gates set on fire. At this point, two men deserted to him, Ananus of Emmaus, the most murderous of Simon's bodyguard, and Archelaus, son of Magadatus, hoping for pardon now that the Jews were losing ground. But Titus reproached them for this very treachery, and having learned of their savagery toward their own people besides, was moved to kill them both, saying they had come over only under compulsion, not by choice, and did not deserve to be spared, since they had leapt clear of their homeland only after it was already in flames because of them. Yet good faith prevailed over his anger, and he let the men go, though he did not rank them equally with the rest. By now the soldiers had set fire to the gates, and the silver melting on them quickly carried the flame into the woodwork, from which it spread in a mass and caught hold of the porticos. As the Jews watched the fire ringing them, their spirits failed along with their bodies, and out of sheer shock no one made a move to fight it or put it out, they simply stood parched and stared. Yet even the ruin of their possessions did not dishearten them into caution for what remained. Rather, now that the sanctuary itself was burning, they sharpened their fury against the Romans all the more. That day and the following night the fire held sway, for the Romans had not been able to set the porticos alight all at once, but only bit by bit. The next day Titus, having ordered part of his force to put out the fire and to clear the ground by the gates for an easier approach for the legions, called his commanders together. When the six most senior men had assembled, Tiberius Alexander, prefect of the whole army, Sextus Cyriales, commander of the 5th legion, Lartius Lepidus of the 10th, Titus Frigius of the 15th, along with Frontohitirius, camp commander of the two legions from Alexandria, and Marcus Antonius Julianus, procurator of Judea. And after these, the procurators and tribunes had also gathered, he put before them the question of the temple. Some thought the law of war should simply be applied, since the Jews would never stop their rebellion so long as the temple stood, since it was the gathering point for people from everywhere. Others advised that if the Jews abandoned it and no one took up arms upon it, it should be spared, but that if they fought from within it, it should be burned. For then it would be a fortress, no longer a temple, and the impiety would belong to those who had forced it, not to the Romans. But Titus said that even if the Jews fought from it, he would not take revenge on lifeless things in place of men, nor would he ever burn down so great a work, since the loss would fall on Rome, just as its survival would be an ornament to his own command. Emboldened by this, Fronto, Alexander, and Cyriales came round to his view. He then dismissed the council, and having ordered the commanders to let the rest of his forces rest, so that he might use fresher men in the coming assault, he directed the picked men from the cohorts to clear a path through the rubble and to put out the fire. That day, exhaustion and shock kept the Jews' impulses in check. But the next day, having gathered their strength and recovered their courage, they sallied out through the eastern gate against the guards of the outer temple at about the second hour. The guards received their charge staunchly, locking their shields together in front like a wall and closing up their line, but it was plain they would not hold out much longer, overwhelmed as they were by the numbers and fury of the attackers. Caesar, watching the balance of the fight tip from his post on the Antonia, for he could see it from there, came to their aid with his picked cavalry. The Jews could not withstand the charge, and once the first ranks fell, most of them turned and fled. As the Romans fell back, they pressed close upon them, and as the Romans wheeled about, they fled again, until about the fifth hour of the day those who had been driven back were shut up inside the inner sanctuary. Titus withdrew to the Antonia, resolved that at dawn the next day he would attack with his whole force and surround the temple. But God, it seems, had long since condemned it to the fire, and the fated day had come round in its cycle. The 10th of the month Luz, the very day on which it had once before been burned by the king of the Babylonians. The flames took their beginning and their cause from the Jews' own men. For when Titus had withdrawn, the rebels, after a brief pause, attacked the Romans again, and a clash broke out between the guards of the temple and those putting out the fire in the inner sanctuary, who routed the Jews and pursued them right up to the temple itself. There one of the soldiers, waiting for no order and fearing no such daring act, moved by some more than human impulse, snatched a burning brand and, boosted up by a fellow soldier, threw the fire in through a golden window that gave access, on the north side, to the chambers around the temple. As the flame rose, a cry went up from the Jews worthy of the calamity, and they rushed together to fight it off, sparing themselves no longer and holding nothing back of their strength, now that the very thing they had been guarding so carefully was slipping away. Someone ran and reported it to Titus. He happened to be resting in his tent after the fighting, and just as he was, he leapt up and ran toward the temple to stop the fire. All his commanders followed after him, and the legions, alarmed, followed them in turn. There was shouting and confusion, as was natural with so great a force moving without order. Caesar, by voice and by gesture, signaled to the fighting men to put out the fire, but they could not hear him shouting, their ears already filled with a greater din, nor did they heed the signs of his hand, some intent on the fighting, others carried away by rage. As the legions poured in, neither exhortation nor threat could hold back their impulse, but fury alone commanded them all. Crowding at the entrances, many were trampled by one another, and many, falling among the still hot and smoking ruins of the porticos, met the same fate as the defeated. Drawing near the temple, they pretended not even to hear Caesar's orders, and urged the men in front of them to throw in the fire. By now the rebels were helpless to bring any aid. There was slaughter and rout everywhere. Most of the dead were ordinary, unarmed, and powerless people of the city, cut down wherever they were caught. Around the altar the bodies piled up in heaps, and blood ran in streams down the temple steps, the corpses of those killed above sliding down with it. When Caesar found he could not restrain the soldiers in their frenzy, and the fire was gaining the upper hand, He went in with his commanders and viewed the sanctuary of the temple and everything within it. Far surpassing, he found, its reputation among foreigners and fully living up to its renown and glory among his own people. Since the flame had not yet reached inside anywhere but was still feeding on the chambers around the temple, he judged, rightly, that the building could still be saved and rushed forward himself, trying to urge the soldiers to put out the fire, and ordered the centurion liberales of his own bodyguard of spearmen to beat back with clubs any who disobeyed. But the men's fury overcame their reverence for Caesar and their fear of the one restraining them, as did their hatred of the Jews and a certain fiercer battle lust. Most of them, besides, were driven by hope of plunder, believing that everything inside was full of treasure, and seeing that all around them was made of gold. But before this, one of the men who had gotten inside, just as Caesar had rushed out to hold back the soldiers, threw fire into the hinges of the gate in the darkness. And then, as flame suddenly blazed up from within, the commanders withdrew along with Caesar, and no one any longer stopped those outside from setting fire to it. So it was that the temple was burned against Caesar's will. One might well lament, considering the work itself, all that we have received by sight and by report of its wonders. The skill and scale of its construction, the costliness of every part, and the glory of its holy places, and yet find the greatest comfort in this. That fate is inescapable, for works and places just as for living beings. One might also marvel at the precision of its cycle. It kept, as I have said, the very same month and the very same day on which the temple had earlier been burned by the Babylonians. From its first founding, laid by King Solomon, to its present destruction, which took place in the second year of Vespasian's reign, the sum comes to 1,130 years, 7 months, and 15 days. And from its later founding, which Haggai carried out in the second year of King Cyrus's reign, to its capture under Vespasian, 639 years and 45 days. While the temple was burning, plunder was seized from all who fell in its path, and the slaughter of those who were caught was boundless. No mercy was shown for age, no respect for rank, children and old men, laymen and priests alike were cut down together, and the war swept up every class of person, both those who begged for mercy and those who fought back. The roar of the flame, carried far and wide, mingled with the groans of the falling. And because of the height of the hill and the scale of the burning structure, one might have thought the whole city was ablaze. As for the outcry, nothing more overwhelming or more terrible could be imagined. The war cry of the Roman legions surging forward, the screams of the rebels ringed by fire and sword, the terror-stricken flight of the people trapped above toward their enemies, and their wailing at their fate. The crowd throughout the city answered the cries of those on the hill with cries of its own, and now many who were wasting away from famine and had lost the power of speech, when they saw the fire on the temple, found strength once more for weeping and lament. Perea and the surrounding mountains echoed back, deepening the roar. Yet more terrible than the noise itself was what lay behind it. One might have thought the temple hill was being shaken to its very roots, so full was it of fire on every side, yet more abundant still was the blood than the fire, and more numerous the slain than the slayers. Nowhere could the ground be seen for the corpses, but the soldiers ran over heaps of bodies in pursuit of those who fled. The mass of the rebels at last forced their way past the Romans and broke out with difficulty into the outer court and from there into the city. The remnant of the ordinary people fled for refuge to the outer portico. Some of the priests at first tore out the spikes of the temple and their sockets, cast in lead, and hurled them at the Romans. But then, seeing this achieved nothing and that the fire was bursting in upon them too, they withdrew to the wall, 8 cubits thick, and there held their ground. But two men of note, though they could have gained safety by going over to the Romans or held out to share the fate of the rest, threw themselves into the fire instead and were burned up together with the temple, Maris son of Belgas and Joseph son of Dalius. The Romans, judging it now useless to spare what remained round about while the temple itself was burning, set fire to everything. The remnants of the porticos and the gates, except two, one on the east and one on the south, and these two they later tore down. They also burned the treasuries, in which lay an immense quantity of money, an immense quantity of clothing, and other valuables. In short, the whole accumulated wealth of the Jews had been stored there, since the rich had moved their household goods into it. They came also to the one remaining portico of the outer temple, where a mixed crowd of women, children, and common people, some 6,000 in all, had taken refuge. Before Caesar could decide anything about them or give an order to his commanders, the soldiers, carried away by rage, set fire to the portico. It happened that some died by throwing themselves out of the flames, and others perished inside it. Of so great a number, not one survived. The man responsible for their destruction was a false prophet, who had proclaimed to the people in the city that very day that God commanded them to go up to the temple to receive the signs of their salvation. There were many such prophets at that time, planted by the tyrants to urge the people to wait for help from God, so that fewer would desert, and so that hope might steady those already gripped by fear and under guard. A man in distress is quickly persuaded, and when the deceiver adds the promise of release from present evils, the sufferer gives himself over entirely to hope. So it was that the wretched people were led astray then by impostors who lied in God's name, while the clear signs that plainly foretold the coming desolation they neither heeded nor believed, but, as if thunderstruck and possessing neither eyes nor minds, disregarded the warnings of God. Once, when a star resembling a sword stood over the city, and a comet that lasted a whole year. And again, when, before the revolt and the stirring toward war, as the people were gathering for the feast of unleavened bread, on the 8th of the month Xanthicus, at the 9th hour of night, so great a light shone round the altar and the temple that it seemed to be broad daylight, and this lasted half an hour. To the inexperienced, it seemed a good omen, but the sacred scribes judged at once, from what followed, what it meant. And at the same feast, a cow, led by someone to the sacrifice, gave birth to a lamb in the middle of the temple court. And the eastern gate of the inner sanctuary, though made of bronze and very massive, and though it took 20 men, closing it with difficulty toward evening, and though it was fitted with iron-bound bars and had bolts sunk very deep into the threshold, itself a single unbroken block of stone, was seen at the 6th hour of night to have opened of its own accord. The temple guards ran and reported it to the captain, who went up and with difficulty managed to shut it again. To ordinary people, this too seemed a most excellent omen, that God had opened for them the gate of blessings. But the learned understood that the security of the sanctuary was loosening of itself, and that the gate was being opened as a gift to the enemy, and among themselves they declared the sign to portend desolation. Not many days after the feast, on the 21st of the month Artemisius, a supernatural apparition was seen, one beyond belief. What I am about to tell would seem a fable, I think, had it not been reported also by eyewitnesses, and had the sufferings that followed not matched the signs. For before sunset, chariots were seen suspended in the air over the whole country, and armed battalions rushing through the clouds and encircling the cities. And at the feast called Pentecost, the priests, entering the inner sanctuary by night as was their custom for their services, said they first became aware of a movement and a din, and after that of a massed voice saying, "We are departing from here." More frightening still than these was the case of a certain Jesus son of Ananias, a common man from the countryside, who 4 years before the war, when the city was enjoying the fullest peace and prosperity, came up for the feast at which it is the custom for everyone to build booths for God, and suddenly began to cry out in the temple. A voice from the east, a voice from the west, a voice from the four winds, a voice against Jerusalem and the temple, a voice against bridegrooms and brides, a voice against all the people. This, by day and by night, he went about crying through all the alleys of the city. Some of the leading citizens, angered at the alarmed cry, seized the man and beat him with many blows. But he said nothing in his own defense, nor anything in private to those striking him, and kept uttering the very same cries as before. The magistrates, concluding, rightly, as it turned out, that the man's impulse was something more than human, brought him before the Roman prefect. There, though torn by scourges to the bone, he neither begged for mercy nor wept, but twisting his voice into the most plaintive tone he could manage, answered every blow with, "Woe, woe to Jerusalem!" When Albinus, for he was then prefect, asked him again and again who he was, where he came from, and why he cried out such things, he answered not a word to any of it, but kept up his lament over the city without pause until Albinus, judging him mad, released him.